Sometimes It Takes a Rocket Scientist with Dr. Pamela Menges.
Hi, this is Dr. Pamela Menges with Sometimes It Takes a Rocket Scientist, and today we have Dr. Robert Bartholomew for our premiere podcast. Enjoy part one. Bart, how are you doing?
Wonderful. I'm actually in Ohio, where I was when we were first connected, and I'm still working at 83 years old, and I'm working a little bit on hypersonics.
Well, I want to introduce you as our premiere podcast for Sometimes It Takes a Rocket Scientist.
Yes, right. And I'm one. Yeah.
And to say that, hey, you were responsible for some of my training when I was getting my doctorate.
Yeah.
And really quickly, you were head of the National Aerospace Plane, the X-30. You were the director for the United States Air Force.
Yes, yes.
And when I met you, you were head of the Systems Directorate as director.
Yes.
At Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Uh-huh.
And I did my doctorate in integrated propulsion and airframe kind of stuff, controls. And we both had serious interest in machine learning and AI. I had my bachelor's degree actually in biomathematics, artificial intelligence. And
wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful, yeah.
And
you were a pioneer there.
Yeah, I was.
You was. You were.
That's why I did it. I did a student-initiated program in math and developmental neurobiology because you had one course in computer science you could take in AI at that point in the universe.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, and you were lucky to find somebody who could actually teach it.
Yeah, right. And now everybody's an AI expert.
Oh, God. And it's really unfortunate because most of the AI we're talking about is so limited.
Sure.
And so narrowly defined. And I wish Congress and the other folks would get ahead of the curve. But that's another conversation for another day, because we want to talk about really some of the early innovation in high-speed vehicle work, and that was horizontal as opposed to vertical. So not rockets or launch systems as we know them, not the rockets, but as space planes.
Yes.
Rocket planes. And of course, the X-15 was one of the first.
Yep.
And that was a very complex vehicle for its day. And some 40 years later, you guys took on a really, what's the term, challenging concept
right.
in the NAF, in the X-30 program. And I can remember you telling me that it was just wonderful vehicle, but from a military perspective, you could take it down with a pea shooter.
Yeah, right. That's right. Well, the problem with hypersonics is that if you mess up the flow in any way, it's going down. I mean, it's a very, it's a wonderful concept, scramjets and things like that. And especially I understand there's a new flat bottom society, which is the part of the hypersonics program. We had a flat bottom with a big scooper, you know, essentially, mm-hmm. and some very complicated engines inside there. But the problem with complication is it's kind of like the digital world too, right? You are vulnerable. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, I've been working on some different models and different concepts over some 20 years. I did my work in this integrated kind of concept, which I've carried on and developed some functional structure, smart structures to do things. And we came up with a pretty cool space plane, two-stage to orbit, nothing terribly fancy. And it is the aerodynamic design, if you want to call it that. It's still kind of brute forcing things. You know how that goes.
Sure.
A hybrid of lifting body wave rider kind of vehicle.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it's done a great job. So in your mind, as we move into hypersonics, what can we learn from what you did at NASP?
Well, I did I think the biggest lesson was not technical. It was probably managerial. And there was a positive lesson as well as a negative lesson. The positive aspect of it was we got everybody in the entire country involved in the NASH program. It was kicked off, and maybe your listeners would like to know this, by President Ronald Reagan's last State of the Union address in 1986. He got up like John Kennedy had done about 10, 20 years before, and said, "We're going to build an airplane that will fly around the world and will fly into space." This is Ronald Reagan. He neglected to say when. And if you remember Kennedy's speech, he says, "In 3 years, we're going to the moon." Okay, well, Reagan was careful enough, and he was a wonderful man. I actually worked for him and Dan Quayle and George H.W. Bush during the NASH program. And I did get to meet these very important, you know, people. And I remember Dan Quayle about 2 years later, he was sort of in charge of the program because the vice president is in charge of NASA, Air Force, DDR&E, DARPA, you know, all the different groups that were involved in hypersonics. And he looked at me and said, "Marty, can we do this?" I said, "We can do it." Again, like Reagan, I never mentioned when. And so he said, "Well, let's go do it." So I think the biggest lesson from NASH was, I would say, organizational, managerial, and that is you can get the nation to work together and to share technical information in a collaborative way, by promising them that later, if there's money to be made, you can go competitive. So we essentially ran a 5-year program with everybody sort of giving their best, including the companies. Now, that's the hardest part, right? I think, anyways, the companies are a bit reticent to share their information, but we had everybody, Boeing and Lockheed and everybody involved in the program. The ones that kind of emerged as the leaders were Rockwell, McDonnell Douglas, General Dynamics. And that to me was the most important thing, that if it's a national program, and if it's one that, you know, you get the president to say it's important, kind of like the moon program, but in this case, Reagan said, "Let's fly around the world." They agreed. And so my biggest job was managing literally 5,000 people in many, many different agencies. But I think that's worth saying, because if there's going to be a real push for hypersonics, however they want to do it, I mean, I'm not going to suggest any particular agency or whatever. It really should be joint agency, joint companies, joint academics. Work together, and that'll get you very, very far. The negative lesson was that we overpromised. I mean, not intentionally, not knowingly. I mean, after all, NASH ended in 1991. And so if you just do the numbers, okay, that's about 30 years ago, 35 years ago, right? Yeah, it's 24 already. And we didn't have the technology then, but we thought, let's give it a go. And I think we tried very hard. We got a lot of people very, very excited. And I think the silver lining around overpromising is that people don't know better, and so they try things that are extremely high risk but high payoff. And we did indeed get some breakthroughs, particularly in the propulsion area. I think that was our biggest good, because we worked with scramjets, we worked with low speed systems that kind of went from Mach 1 to Mach 3. We already knew how to do Mach 3 because of the Blackbird work, you know, and I flew the Blackbird and tried to control the engines above 3, 3.5. And then that was not the biggest problem. The problem today and then was, how do you get to 7 or 8, and how do you do that stably? And I love your concept. I think there's two ways of looking at what you propose. The way you have done it, which I think is very, very sound, very practical, very doable. A rocket. I'm sorry?
It's accessible.
It's accessible, yeah. The rocket to get you up to, you know, a certain speed, and then you go from there. I also think, and I think there is some some investigatings where you use ramjets and scramjets and whatever the first stage system is, to get to about, you know, Mach 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. And then you use rocketry of some sort, you know, because there's very little air up there. That was the NASP concept. Get up to 7 or 8. And then now we had this fascinating concept of catching the air on the way up and using it as the oxygen. Remember that one? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, it's doable. It's accessible. As you say, it's doable. There's so many programs now. I'm sure you and your listeners are much more aware than I am of all the programs going on. There isn't a school of note that doesn't have a hypersonic activity program, institute even. There's not a company in the aerospace world that isn't at least playing with this thing and, you know, seeing what's going on. And the government, my goodness, the government has so many people going on this. James Webber, who was one of my pals, my colleagues, even in the NAS days, is now heading up the DDR&E program, which is the DOD program in hypersonics. And I haven't talked to James yet, but I hope he pulls together the team. So good lesson, bad lesson. Collaboration is wonderful. And it's hard to get in a competitive world. But on the other hand, it pays off tremendously. So I'll stop there.
Well, that's cool. And I think that's really interesting because I don't know if you recall, but my internship, because I had to do a doctoral internship because of the program I was doing, was looking at using expert systems with AI agents and how you manage large scale engineering and databases for programming. And I've in the recent years, my father started his career on the Manhattan Project. He was an engineer for DuPont, and I have all his papers, and I've been going through them and reading. It's amazing. What you're talking about with NASP is similar to what they did on the Manhattan Project, though commercially, from an enterprise perspective, it was radically different. DuPont didn't take any really money for the project other than their expenses, because in their mind at that point, because the world was a different world, that the new science they were learning would change their world, which it did.
Sure.
I see some extraordinary similarities between NASP and DuPont, and NASP was a classified program. And the one company I want to do a call out to, because they were so nice to me when I was working on my doctorate, I can remember calling you in your office one day, and I think you had a general sitting in the lobby.
I think I did. I always love that.
And I said, hey, who do you know with slush hydrogen? And you gave me like three names and telephone numbers. And I called them, and one guy was like a VP of Ball Aerospace.
Yeah, right. Engineering.
Wonderful guy. And he sat on the phone with me for like an hour and gave me a tutorial on slush hydrogen. So working with you was fabulous, because all I had to say, well, Bart said, oh, what time do you want to talk? Yeah.
Well, that was the good old days. They don't really respond that well to me right now. I mean, we're still a lot of friends. You know, Pam, you're one of the first that's directly reached out to me. But a lot of people, yesterday I was invited to kick off the Air Force Institute Technology Hypersonics Program. I don't know if he was Jose Cambreros. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
He's running the AFIT program now. So I think of you, I think of James Webber, I think of Jose as young people when the NAS program was going. I mean, I was a
kid when the NAS program was going, but now I'm middle-aged.
Yeah, I know.
I'm an expert, for God's sakes.
Yeah. All my followers are middle-aged, not my colleagues. They're gone. Well, some of them are truly gone, but most of them have long retired. And every once in a while, I don't know if you remember Ted Wierzbanowski. W plus 12. So he is living in Florida in Punta Gorda. And we just met up the other day and we had great old wine parties, you know, reminiscing the fun days of NASA. He was a test pilot for the X-29 and he was.
Yeah, I know. I'd love to interview him at some point. So
I'll tell him. Yeah, I'll ask him or I'll give you his address if that's
okay. That's great. I'm a tester. You know, I got 15 years as a flight test engineer.
Yeah.
Because I've done so many I've driven everything but a gyrocopter or a submarine. I've driven.
Did you get a chance to fly in the Blackbird?
No, I have not.
Well, I did, and I actually did some engine control during the flight. We actually, I don't know if I should say this publicly, but I think we actually went too far. It went a little bit faster than what the engine and the pilot said. Whoa, we better get down to 3.5 or whatever, was the max speed. And we were up to 90,000, 92,000 feet. I saw the curvature of the earth, and I think this is kind of a trivial reason for hypersonics. But it's a personal and maybe even spiritual reason that if you get up that high with a hypersonic vehicle, you don't have to go all the way to low Earth orbit, which you can, of course, with that vehicle. But you get the same effect. It's called the overview effect that the astronauts have had, where they look down on this little blue ball and then see anything but peace, because from that altitude, you're getting this atmosphere and all that. But then you think to yourself, boy, there's a lot of trouble going on down there, and I hope they solve it pretty quick. So.
Yeah, we don't have borders drawn on the planet.
No, wait, that's right. That's a great point. Great point. Yeah.
Well, one thing I want to do really quickly is that you had an interesting background before you became an SES executive person in the Air Force. You were MIT trained,
Yep.
Ohio State trained. You did work at Tullahoma. Did you work MHD, didn't you, Michael?
Magnetohydrodynamics. Yeah, that was my, and we still haven't captured the potential of magnetohydrodynamics. A big
Well,
long
that's how
word.
we met. That's how we met. I was introduced to
Well,
you because I was working on a wind tunnel in my workshop slash laboratory, which is a 200-year-old carriage house, and basically built a little wind tunnel where I could do because I, was trained in physics, look at ionized profiles for different aerodynamic effects in terms of leading edge extensions and how do we change airflow? Because a big part of what we want to do in hypersonics is reduce the thermal profile of the vehicle, particularly at the bow and just in the front part of the space plane or spacecraft or aircraft, a space plane, I should say,
Or space plane.
aerospace plane. And that was, for many years, the vehicle we had, basically the front bow of it was a block of machined titanium.
Yeah,
Just, yeah, so it wouldn't disintegrate.
right. Pretty hot up there. Yeah,
Because
right.
you want to keep that shock wave separated. Because if
Yeah.
you lose your separation, you are really in
You're
trouble.
in big trouble. Yeah. Yeah. Ted Wierzbanowski, since we just mentioned him, said, if I fly this plane and we get in trouble, just like you said, Pam, I'm going up. I'm not going down. Yeah. I'm firing the rockets. Get out of here.
How was the re-entry profile for that?
For NASP? Yeah. Well, of course, we never really tested it. I mean, we just have wind tunnel testing and things like that. Well, the reentry is a whole different situation, because the airplane at that point is much lighter. You've used up every possible thing, and you're right, slush hydrogen was the preferred fuel for the NASP program. That's always been an issue, and just because of the difficulty, the logistics of slush hydrogen. I really do believe that a lot of the work going on right now in the scramjet world and hypersonics world are looking at fuels that are much easier, to deal with. May not be JP whatever, but it might be something else. The reentry, we did do a lot of work on the reentry, and it was quite different than the takeoff, obviously. You got a lot of speed. I would think that it might gain from learning how the yes, the shuttles came down. The And one of my good friends, Charlie Kamada, I don't know if you met him or know him. He's an astronaut that went up a year after the tragic tile problem that crashed the vehicle over Texas. He was a materials engineer, and Charlie went up with the new set of tiles, and systems that they had. And he says, you can't ignore a reentry here. You just, because, as Ted said, it's safer upstairs than it is downstairs. And he was referring to, there ain't anything up there you're going to hit, whatever. But coming down, you better watch yourself. If anything goes wrong there, it's a plummet. And of course, that tile catastrophe did crashed the plane, and I think it fell off or something. So Charlie went up on the it took a year before NASA was willing to fly again, and so Charlie went up on that.
A big part of it was they lost the gear door on the left wing.
But it coming down ain't no simple thing, right?
Yeah. No, and it, you don't want to skip.
No, right? Yeah, you don't want to skip. And you know, when I fly in airplanes, just like you do, coming down is usually pretty controlled, especially with commercial airlines. I mean, you could do it blindfolded, but still, you know, you don't want to mess up. The ground is beneath you.
Yeah. Hey. Another question. You were director of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics.
Yes.
Serious question. I was at one time a member of probably close to a dozen professional societies when I was younger. And do you think professional societies today are doing everything they should be doing in terms of the formation of engineers and the way businesses are operating in this country, because we seem to be ignoring small businesses where a lot of the innovation is?
Absolutely. So, you know, that's a fascinating question. I've thought about that myself, because, you know, when you think of national programs, you know, what is a better national entity than an institute, a society, like you just mentioned? I mean, they supposedly have no prejudices, you know, everything's good, everything that, you know, moves science forward. And they are very important with young people. I think, you know, I was a member of AIAA, a director. I used to go to all these high schools and colleges and all that, and try to. The other thing they can do is steer, I don't mean negatively, steer the kids, the students rather, to areas of great importance, because any given university might take in a young freshman, you know, who might be brilliant at the time. And if you're working aeronautics or hypersonics, they will have a sweet spot. That university will, you know, have professors that are doing it. When I think AIAA, and, you know, similarly IEEE and all other ones, you know, could really look at the future and look at the needed technologies and the needed, you know, capabilities, which includes human beings, and steer that in the proper direction. People don't have to abide by what they say, but it's neutral, right? In theory. Right. And so if they say the real, you made an interesting point. The real problem may be heat transfer, okay, or maybe hotspots or something like that, okay? Well, a guy in aeronautics may never get too involved in that. But a guy in, in hypersonics, but in aeronautics or materials engineering, they may go, oh, let's try to fix that. You know, let's work together. I still think, Pam, and I think that's why NASA was so wonderful, that multi-technologies is where the future is, okay? Not a technology, not aeronautics or hypersonics or materials. It's where you get a young materials engineer talking with a, you know, scramjet hypersonic guy, and also a fluid flow guy from, you know, I don't know what department, that chemical engineering, let's say, okay? And you get them talking. And I think we all know that while professors and very eminent professors are smart as heck, the innovation comes from the individual, and the individual and the younger, honest to God, you know what I'm working with? Fifth graders on a problem. Here's the problem. How to extract a astronaut that gets trapped for whatever reason in a crater on the moon. That's something that we're going to have to face probably in a few years, you know, and that's not an easy problem. I got 50 kids who are in an academy, a STEAM academy, not STEM, but STEAM, and they are working on this problem, and they are coming up with the most interesting solutions that are, you know, nothing that NASA's thinking about. So the younger, I mean, there's a limit, obviously, but I'm telling you, a fifth grader who's 10 years old, roughly speaking, okay, can give you a lot of wild ideas that, of course, the engineer has to say, well, wait a minute, that's not practical. But these kids are so smart today. I mean, as soon as I posed the problem, they wanted an hour off. And I said, why do you want to know? Oh, we have to go to Google. We have to find out what's out there, you know, which I think is wonderful. Let's figure out what's out there, you know, so. So, yeah, I think the societies could really do more. They're kind of, I don't know, they're kind of like honorary things today in a way. I mean, a lot of them honorary, you know.
Well, they tend to ignore the small companies that are doing the most innovative
stuff. Absolutely.
which I don't understand. And unfortunately, a lot of the folks in Washington take their leads from what the professional societies are doing.
Sure.
And I don't know if you remember, but I was a NASA Institute for Advanced Concepts fellow. And the reason I'm saying this is NIAC at that time was under the University Space Research Association. So it was at arm's length from actually NASA. And the interesting thing about that is Dr. Bob Casanova built a virtual think tank. And he was able to access small businesses, national laboratories, universities around the country, and bring in new ideas and how to do things. And I actually said, hey, let's see if we can use a neurogenesis algorithm to control a smart structure. And what kind of devices do we need to do that? And they funded it. And basically, okay, it's a flapping wing map of my aerial vehicle. Okay, fine. That was my demonstration. I said, so let's see if we can do it. Well, in a year since then, yeah, we can do it. And not only that, basically, it's the foundations of what become neuromorphic computing and intelligent mechatronics and all those things, because we're not going to be able to divide our world into disciplines anymore.
Absolutely.
We have to
Absolutely.
be, it's going to be applications, not disciplines.
Absolutely. Well, I'm now also getting involved in something very different, and that is global responsibility for the future of our young people, which is beyond technology. And I'm not an expert. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a philosopher. But I wrote a book called Godlike, and I'd be happy to send it to you, Pam, if you don't have it. And I have an Udemy course on Godlike, and it's not religious. Okay, so I mean the title obviously will perk up people. It's mostly a scientific explanation or whatever, very basic for. I mean, it'll be way under your head, but for most people, it's just at the boundary. I mean, if you want to talk about Big Bang, the people go, "What's a Big Bang?" And you and I know that, but it allows people to think that, look, there's a lot we know about this world, and it's kind of frightening in some sense that we are so limited in our ability to be collaborative, to work together, to be beyond discipline. I love that term that you said. I usually use multidisciplinary, but I think yours is better, beyond discipline. Because now, of course, the academics go crazy when you talk about that. Okay, well, I got to close my course 22 or something on that. MIT, which is my alma mater, I went there. I've gone back for various reasons. And they have a lot of institutes now, and they have as many institute as courses. When I went to MIT way back in the 50s, they had like 25 courses. So I was chemical engineering, nuclear engineering. All. Now they still have the 25 courses, but they have as many institutes that are over the top.
Absolutely. And they've got a
And
new
so
institute.
the big schools have figured out, that it's crud. Now it's hard to teach. It's more problem based. You're capability based. You say, how can we have a hypersonic plane or something like that? Then you bring in the professors from the various departments, and you work the kids that way too. It's a big challenge for them because for 300 years, universities have pretty much done the same thing, including the techies. They taught disciplines.
Well, that's why I took the program I did, because,
Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah, you did. You were a pioneer. You truly were. That's why I love to work with you, because I thought I either she's going to get shot by the academicians or whatever, or she's going to really break through
Oh, the
someplace.
academics still hate me. Don't worry
Oh,
about
I'm sure they
it.
do. Yeah. And they hate me for saying that too. And then I go, look, I don't care. You just got to think about it. If you don't care, I don't care about me, but you got to think about the future here. So we'll see.
Join us next time on Sometimes It Takes a Rocket Scientist for Part 2. Dr. Pamela Mensch's interview with Dr. Bart Bartholomew.